All right, we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 3539. And we've got,
is that the easiest one of the bunch?
I hope so.
Mr. Chairman, we've got Representative Merkley's here. I had Ted from LC, Ted Rutlinger from LC, come here as well. I don't think they signed up. And then they've got Scott Berry from the homeowners, Harlan Libby, OAR, and Yvonne Arnell. So.
All right, Representative Merkley, you created this problem. Why don't you get up here and tell us why we're fixing it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Representative Jeff Merkley from East Portland. I've asked Vinette Arnell to come this morning, who initiated the process that led to this bill, to briefly summarize the problem that her family encountered.
All right.
My name is Vinette Arnell, and I'm from Gresham. And thank you for having me today. Representative Merkley has asked me to just give you a brief outline of the situation that happened to my family and how this impacted us, but I'd be happy to elaborate or answer any questions that you may have. Early in 1999, we contracted with a builder to build a home for us in Gresham. And in August of that year, my husband and I and our seven children moved into that home right before school started. Within a couple of months, we began receiving liens from the subcontractors on our home. And we questioned this because we had, been through closing. We knew that we had title insurance. We had mortgage insurance. We had paid for our home in full. So we questioned why we would have these liens and found out that there really was no protection for us, and that the contractor had in fact experienced some severe financial problems of his own and was unable to pay his subcontractors, and they were now coming after us. At one point, I had over 17 liens on my home. The home, we had liens against it worth half again what it was already worth. We were going to have to pay for our house in effect twice. And it got so far as to be, one of the subcontractors took it as far as a sheriff's sale so that it would be sold for the to cover the liens. We were able to salvage it and save it to a huge financial burden on our family. This situation also impacted about a dozen other homeowners in our subdivision, and some of them weren't able to salvage their homes. We had two families who experienced bankruptcy trying to save their homes. We had several families that moved out and abandoned their homes and had their credit ruined because they were not able to salvage their homes. And at this point in our neighborhood, in a three-block radius of my house, we currently have two abandoned homes because the families were not able to salvage them, pay the liens, take care of the homes, and so they're abandoned properties. Our neighborhood, which was a moderate middle-income neighborhood in a nice area of Gresham, is now referred to as the ghetto, and homes that are only 4 years old, people are unable to sell them. And this has been financially devastating to many families and to our community. And I would just speak out in strong support of this bill and really ask you to consider passing this today, because it would prevent other families from going through the problems that our family faced. And this kind of a landmine really needs to be eliminated in the home buying process.
All right.
Thank you, Vinette. The process that led to this is the last session of the legislature adopted a bill that was a full disclosure bill, but it became a kind of a consensus opinion in the industry that approach led to way too much paperwork, and we suspended implementation of that bill until January 1994 to give this legislature the time to find a better path. Over the interim, we held many work group sessions, brainstormed over how to solve this problem within the structure of Oregon lien law, and came out eventually with this plan, which is essentially says the seller needs to warn or protect the buyer and can do so through their own choice of any of the instruments available. And there are six instruments laid out in this bill. Those instruments include a bond, waivers from the potential lien holders, delaying the sale of a home until the time for filing liens has expired, maintaining funds in escrow, providing title insurance, and or finally, basically warning the buyer about the structure of lien law and getting in Oregon so that they fully understand what they're doing and getting a waiver from them. So those are the six possible protections. I'll be happy. I'm going to keep this very brief, but I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'd greatly appreciate your support.
All right, Representative Murphy, what's the impact on these various industries if we don't fix this?
Thank you. If we don't fix this, what happens in January is the original bill that was passed last session comes into effect, and I think that you will hear from folks here today that there's great concern in two ways. One, that the solution provided in that earlier legislation may be unworkable. Unworkable because a seller, under ordinary circumstances, may not have copies of the potential rights to lien that they're required to pass on to the buyer. Sometimes these liens are undocumented, or rights to lien are undocumented, or simply the buyer isn't aware that they should keep a copy, or the seller should keep a copy to pass on to the buyer. So there may be many, many inadvertent violations of the law in that case. And also there's great concern among the real estate industry that the bill didn't provide protection so that an agent of the seller may find themselves unwittingly exposed to mistakes made by the actual owner of the property. So those were the two big concerns. And I think this bill will do a lot better in getting us towards a workable solution. And I should mention also that Mr. Marquis is here on behalf of the Mortgage Lenders Association and the United Financial Lobby. Rather than sign up, he asked me to indicate his support, and also that he is going through the process of having a home built right now and so is experiencing these issues firsthand. And Mr. Barrows is here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, also in support of the bill, and both gentlemen are available to answer questions if desired.
All right. Any questions? Representative Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I have a letter here from Paul Schultz, an attorney in Neola, and he sent it to you, and then you sent a letter back to him saying that you would have his concerns reviewed. Have you addressed the concerns that he outlined in his letter? We can dispense with his hyperbole and just get right down to his issues. And have you taken care of those problems?
Thank you very much, Senator Walker and Mr. Chair. I forwarded that letter to Mr. Brian DeMarco, real estate lawyer for the real estate, I'm not sure their formal title, but Real Estate Association, and also to legislative counsel. They analyzed that and attempted to make sure that all of the issues that they felt were significant and legitimate concerns within that letter were addressed.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferrioli.
The amount of the bond, if it's in the A and gross inversion equation, it's 25% of the value of the construction. And that's for each and every project.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, Mr. Chair. The bond is one of the six options. So the concept is that the seller would choose which of those six options would be most beneficial. If they choose the bond, indeed it is listed here at the amount that you indicated. My expectation is that most sellers are going to look first to title insurance, and second, if they are close to the expiration of the timeline, to wait for the expiration of the timeline, because that is the most secure and easiest way to meet the requirements of this law. But we wanted to provide all, during the work group, many people came up with different ideas of potential ways that under different circumstances would be the best choice. And so we decided, well, let's give the seller their option among those choices. But if they choose the bond, that is the correct amount.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, continue.
If this 25% of the purchase price is the amount of a bond of the letter of credit, we just heard testimony that the default of the builder created liens 1.5 times the value or the sale price of the residence. So how would a 25% of the purchase price bond do anything other than simply reduce the liability rather than eliminate or indemnify against the liability?
Thank you, Senator. Your point that this bond would not fully protect the buyer is correct. Many buyers experience different lien levels from a few hundred dollars to many thousands, and in dramatic cases, a significant portion of the house, 50% or more of the original value of the house. And I think your bonds total about $70,000, mm-hmm. or
yes.
your liens.
Half of them.
So the 25% bond would have been about $50,000. Dollars, and the liens would have been over $70,000. And you're right, it would not have provided full protection. And this bill does not provide full protection, but it's a significant step towards educating the consumer and providing much more significant protection. To give you a contrast to the existing bond structure, a builder needs to have a bond of $15,000. They can do work that may involve 20, 30, 40, or 100 houses with that $15,000 bond. So now you're looking at one house having a bond of $50,000 if they choose that option. So that would be much more significant protection than we have currently.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to want to hear from the folks that issue title insurance about the perfection of liens and the current statute that requires contractors' liens to be perfected, the timelines and the circumstances under which unperfected liens could be recorded or would be dismissed. I guess it's my impression that you cannot indemnify against all these risks. I mean, I understand the problem. I just don't understand how you could possibly indemnify against all the potential losses unless the builder were to carry a letter of credit or some kind of an indemnity policy on every project for the full value.
Thank you, Senator and Chair. I think it was the consensus of the working group not to seek full indemnification, but to take a significant step in alerting and the consumer and providing a level of protection, a much more significant level than exists in the law now. The timeline that ensnares people is 75 days from substantial completion. And so if I sell a house within, say, 5 days after I've completed it, I close the contract, if you will, the next 70 days, the next 2.5 months are a period in which the subcontractors, if not paid, file these liens. That's why the time limit under one of these options says that you don't need to do these if let me find it here, escrow option E under section 2. Let's see, that's A, B, C.
Representative Merkley, it's on the A engrossed bill. It's with an A4's members committee. It's page 2, line 37.
Thank you. That line is complete the sale of the residential property after the deadline for perfecting all claims of liens with respect to the property. And that in itself would then protect the home buyer completely. Also, the option, if a seller chooses one of the least expensive options, which is to obtain lien waivers from their primary subcontractors, those who are doing work of over $5,000. That option also would provide virtually complete protection for the buyer.
All right. Thank you, Walker.
Thank you.
Senator, another question.
Thank you. Representative, I forgot to ask you this one question. It kind of gets to the point that the chair was making about what happens if we don't do anything. And this letter I'd received from Mr. Schultz said that there are very few purchasers of homes who have this problem. But we heard from Ms. Arnell that it was her several homes in her subdivision. Can you address about how many people you know of that have been caught in this problem, and it is a significant, is it a significant enough problem that we need to fix it?
Thank you, Senator Walker and Mr. Chair. The statistics are weak because there is no formal process for recording the problem. However, you can get some small indication by reviewing the records of the liens filed when a contractor goes out of business. In the situation of the builder who built the home that Mrs. Arnell purchased, my memory, I believe that there were over 100 folks who filed against that builder. And the interesting thing is that this may reflect, is that about right? Or do you know the number? I could certainly follow up to get that information, but the point is it was a significant number, and many people don't file because they call up and they say to the Construction Contractors Board, we're considering filing a claim because we have this problem. And the Construction Contractors Board says, well, you know, there's already 50 people in line with liens totaling $200,000, $300,000 against that $15,000 bond. So this may help you with civilian judgment if you follow through, but you're not going to get a piece of that bond. And that message that the bond is basically fully exhausted many, many times over is very discouraging, and homeowners may go another route rather than trying to pursue a decision through the Construction Contractors Board. So there is no one central place to record all of the problems. At the same time that we were working on this, a contractor in eastern Oregon went out of business, and that contractor, my understanding, is left over 30 homeowners in a similar situation. If I had to guess, if based on the general discussions held over the last couple of years, it's dozens of families a year that are devastated by this situation.
Thank you.
Right. Yes, Senator Rico.
Representative Merkley, could you tell me again who was involved in the work group?
Thank you, Senator Ringo. It varied at various times, but the collected stakeholders included the Mortgage Lenders Association, the Oregon Bankers Association. Later on, we worked with the title insurance company because we didn't include them originally, and they had some points that they wanted accommodated in the bill. And I believe Jack Monroe is here if he needs to address any points. The real estate lobby was a key part of this. Brian DeMarco, lawyer for the real estate
agency. Real estate agency,
thank you, was a key part of the group. And then we had various
home builders,
yes. We have Scott Berry is here to, I think, signed up to address this from the viewpoint of the contractors. We also had Jessica Harris from the commercial contractors were involved, and maybe three or four other people who had expressed interest.
And as far as you know, they're all okay with this bill?
That is my understanding, although I haven't spoken to every single one of them. Those who are in this room, I've spoken to with one or two exceptions, but I believe that there's a consensus that this is probably about as good of strategy under Oregon law as we can get.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony. All right. I've got Scott Berry and Harlan Levy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've got others that want to come up and chat about those or not. But you're all welcome.
Good morning, Senator Menes. Members of the committee, Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I will make my comments very brief. This bill is a group effort, I think, to try to find a solution to a problem that exists. It's not a common problem. I'm not aware of any other situations other than the two subdivisions that were mentioned earlier by Representative Merkley. But a problem does exist when a new home is sold and the contractor that built the home goes out of business within the next 75 days. If that home was sold in the first 75 days, there is a window there where the consumer could get stuck with liens. Again, not a problem we see very often, but not one we are excited to see or happy about. So I think this bill represents an attempt at solving that problem. How it works on the ground is, I think, something that remains to be seen. We are supportive because we need the bill, and we need the section of the bill that repeals the bill from the 2001 session 3840. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and that's where we stand on this bill right now.
All right. Any questions? Zippo, Mr. Levy.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We also support this bill with the -A4 amendments. Specifically, Mr. Berry mentioned it. If you look on page 6 of the Ayn Gross bill, it's currently labeled as Section 9. With the A4 amendments, that becomes Section 12. It's very important that you move this bill out for that purpose, to repeal that bill that passed in the 01 session. We do support this. We thank Representative Merkley for working with us and considering our input throughout the work group during the interim, and I would ask that you move the amended bill out today. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
So what happens if we don't?
Senator Menace, members of the committee, I think that the problem without moving the bill today, or moving the bill this session, really, would be that House Bill 3840 from the 2001 session would go back into effect as of January 1st, 2004. That therein lies the major issue for I think for our association and public for the realtors as well.
And what bad thing happens if that occurs?
Well, I think the problem that would occur, Senator Menace and committee members, is the simple fact that most folks don't keep the kind of records that would be necessary to comply with that bill, and therefore would be in violation.
Okay. Senator Menace, can I add something to that?
You certainly can.
For the record, again, Harlan Levy, there were some criminal sanctions attached to that bill as well, and so you could have a situation where a perfectly innocent seller, just because they didn't have the proper records when they sold their home, would be committing a crime based on that bill that passed in the 01 session.
Okay. Suffice it to say, it's a big problem. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on this fine piece of legislation? Nobody's stepping forward. How about that? Well, then. Let's do a work session.
Chairman.
Madam Vice Chair.
I would move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3539.
Senator Burdick now moves the -A4 amendments to House Bill 3539. Discussion. Any objection? No objection?
No.
Senator Walker.
There's no objection. I just hope that we fix the problem this time and don't have to come back next session because this didn't work out. But
that's why we have sessions every year.
I know.
Or every 3 months. Seems like.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move House Bill 3539 as amended to the Senate floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 3539 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? There's no objection. The motion passes. And Senator Starr, you've been a home builder before. You want to carry this puppy?
I'll do it.
All right. Great. Senator Starr is going to carry the bill. And the next exciting thing we're going to chat about today is a little issue with Fire District 10. And let's see. What's the bill? 2278. Continue the work session. We've got a host of possible amendments and discussions, a work group with Senator Walker, Senator Ferrioli. The A15 amendments apparently causing some mild myocardial infarctions amongst individuals associated with the city of Portland. So we want to chat about it. I think first turn to Senator Walker and Senator Farioli, and let's talk about what it is that you folks came up with. And I know you have a different set of amendments, I think, or a concept that we used to chat about. And then Mark Ellsworth is here somewhere. Yeah, okay. All right. Senator Farioli, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the work group met a couple of times at least for some fairly involved and complicated discussions about the general history and the circumstances that led up to the conditions and circumstances that we have today regarding Fire District 10. We got a little history about how a merger between districts was conducted without fully agreeing between the districts who would be responsible for unfunded future liability. There was a question about full disclosure. There was also some clear indications that once the liability had been apportioned, that the jurisdictions were not notified for years of an unfunded portion of their mandate. That led to a cliff effect where an audit at first indicated that some of the organizations that had an unfunded liability had not been notified. They subsequently were notified, and I guess you could say we have an example of fairly significant sticker shock because they were notified of a liability that had been going on for some 14 or 15 years, and they had never been billed for that liability. Just in general terms, looking at the circumstances, we really had a difficult time assigning culpability with the jurisdictions, other than we could see that the parties may not have been quite equal in negotiation. The parties were not notified. But there certainly was a failure on the part of PERS to notify the folks of the actuarial liabilities that they had incurred. And it's also very clear that the all the jurisdictions are not equal in terms of their ability to assume the now identified unfunded mandate under PERS. The liability has grown to around $75 million. There was an attempt by the working group to approach four or five different methods of appropriation of this of funds or the allocation of the liabilities. And to that end, we met at least twice with the PERS staff, and we directed them to put into memorandum form an approach that would apportion the liability between all of the jurisdictions, credit the payments that had been made by some of the jurisdictions, and essentially come up with a formula that actually used the reserve fund to help pay part of the liability. In other words, and I guess for the first time I heard the term coined to the socialization of some of the unfunded mandate. And that led the working group to have a lengthy discussion about whether or not by allowing a change in the statutes that would access the reserve fund under certain circumstances, we wouldn't be incenting the financial dissolution and failure, actually, of some of the smaller jurisdictions that may have unfunded mandates that they cannot pay, or whether we were being responsible in looking at a pooling concept of risk, because many jurisdictions in the state of Oregon, smaller jurisdictions especially, have an unfunded mandate, and they may be in relatively difficult financial condition either now or in the foreseeable future. The heartening thing about this, if there is any good news about it, is that the circumstances surrounding Fire District 10 have generated the largest single liability magnitude or order that's quite substantial. This $74-75 million is the top unfunded liability in this class that we were able to identify. The next largest one is under $50,000. So you've got $75,050,000. I mean, it drops out pretty substantially. But it doesn't mean that we won't encounter the same circumstances in the future. So it was one of the work group's intentions to create a mechanism that would fairly apportion the liabilities among the jurisdictions and essentially require them to acknowledge that they had a liability now and forever, and of course for all other circumstances as well, by making it part of the policy, but also under certain circumstances to allow the socialization of the unfunded mandate. We were also particularly concerned about the idea that some of these jurisdictions were never notified that they had a liability. In order to make sure that that does not occur, there's going to be need to be some changes in the way PERS does business. There's going to be a change in definition, or need a change in definition of what constitutes an actuarial emergency that would provide access to the contingency fund. And then finally, what we asked Mr. Voitko and PERS to do was to set forth a series of steps that could be codified in legislation that would walk us through identification of the unfunded liability, apportionment to all the jurisdictions, and then finally a distribution of that debt, socialization of the remainder, and then an adjustment of the rates rather than a cash payment required from any of the...
All right. Senator, if I'm looking correctly, there's a memorandum marked draft dated August 15th.
Yes.
You, Senator Walker, and Mark Ellsworth, and is that's the sum of that work?
Mr. Chairman, there are two August 15th memos.
Right.
One of them is titled Memorandum and Mark Draft. I think that's the first version. And the second one is Additional Analysis. Okay. And if you look at these two together, basically what it does is ascribes a percentage of liability and allocates those among the employer base, suggested lump sum transfers of allocated liabilities, and then offers the opportunity through statute to socialize the unfunded portion of the debt, and then finally recaps the rate adjustments that would be necessary to amortize the unfunded liability.
And do we have amendments?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have amendments that encompass these things. They have, in fact, been requested, I believe, or have they not been requested? They have not. Our intention was to bring this product back to the committee to vet this before the committee before we had the amendments drafted.
All right. So let's do that. I don't know. Do the folks in the audience have copies of these PERS memos? Referring to. There should be.
Mark.
All right. Why don't we get a bunch of chairs up here and we'll get a representative from Portland, professional. I don't know if Fairview's represented, Lee Morgan City's whoever might be doing that. Fire District 10 I know is here, and I'm not sure if Troutdale's represented or not. Can kind of walk through this a little bit. And
Mr. Chair, while they're coming forward, I'd like to just add a little bit. There was an August 4th memo that Mr. Voitko provided to Senator Farioli and I, and it was talking about orphan pension obligations and how they arise, and this is really an orphan pension obligation. No one's really claimed that they were going to pay for it at the time. The problem with pension obligations that become orphaned is that if you want the contingency reserve to pay for that, Senate Bill 134 that we passed last session will not allow that unless the entity from which the obligation originally came from is bankrupt. And so we would have to prove that they were insolvent and bankrupt before we could use the contingency fund for that purpose. So that added another element that we needed to fix in this legislation is how would we allow use of the contingency fund to cover this issue if Fire District 10 indeed is still solvent. And the testimony that we received was that they would probably be insolvent within 2 years but they're not insolvent now.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, sure. Just one further word, a strong suggestion from the working group, and I think FIRS certainly agrees, is that there should be no possibility of orphaned unfunded actuarial liabilities. And the way to accomplish that is that PERS and the employers must communicate whenever there is an assumption of liability to apportion what the liability is and what the unfunded liability is, and get full disclosures and disclaimers from everybody so that when these mergers of district or transfers of employees occur, they don't occur in such a way to create an unintentional consequence for any of the employer jurisdictions. And that's what we have here because of a failure to fully disclose and possibly a due diligence lapse from the agency.
All right.
And I think that's reflected in at least in the amendment that was drafted that's before us today. That language is in there.
Is
appropriate.
All right. Well, let's talk about this. And let's focus on the draft from the work group as opposed to the A15 amendment, which is a more drastic approach. Tell me whether you like it, don't like it, hate it. It's interesting. The city of Wood Village, Fairview, and Troutdale, I don't think, are represented here today, which may be somewhat of a problem. So why don't we talk about this particular approach? Tell me what you think.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start if I might. I'm Marge Cafori, representing the city of Portland, and I am a little unclear. I don't know that I have in front of me exactly what the work group is proposing that is
hey,
not.
Mark, would you help her get on the same page with us?
Reading the Mark draft, which is that.
But what I'm looking at, and Senator Walker, Senator Farrelly, help me if I'm not understanding this correctly, but there's an allocated unfunded liability to Portland of $21,871,246.
Okay, then I do have that. Thank you. That's dated August 13th in a memorandum that I have.
Okay.
Anyway, I have the number before.
All right.
Okay, thank you. We did participate in, and I just recall, one work group of all of the affected parties, or all the interested parties. We did participate in that work group, and there were a number of alternative proposals that were suggested at that work group, so we were anticipating getting that together at some point and being able to review a number of different alternatives. But I do want to explain to the committee an offer that the City of Portland has made to attempt to resolve this problem.
Well, I don't want to talk about that right now. I want to talk about this concept that the work group presented.
Then I think I'll defer to Steve Manton, if I might, who is with the Office of Management and Finance with the City of Portland and who is an expert on these PERS matters.
Right.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, Steve Manton with the Office of Management and Finance for the City of Portland. The steps that PERS has gone through to first isolate the unfunded liability, calculate it properly, and then allocate it out appear to be logical, at least, and they do use the allocation numbers that were derived in 1989, I believe, or 94, I believe it was, when almost all of District 10 tax base had been annexed by the different cities. And I think these are numbers that we all agreed on even at that point. So it seems to be a fair assumption of where the unfunded actuarial liability should go. I haven't had a chance to review these numbers before today. Today is the first time I've seen them, actually. But I think there's some logic to them.
All right.
Excuse me. Did I hear you right? You think there's some logic to them? Is
yes.
What you said? Okay. Well, that's what I want to hear.
Mr. Chairman, because we don't have anything in writing, that is the essence of what your work group came up with.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to the good senator. I guess our situation with Fire District 10 in particular, and we're hoping this is an anomaly in the system, is that we didn't want to create a situation, a continuous situation, where the burden on Fire District 10 was such that they could not pay the unfunded liability, couldn't default on the obligation, to have the liability continue with Fire District 10 without some sort of socialization, it would make nearly impossible any subsequent assimilation of either the district or its employees or the obligation. So there are, you know, there's hold harmless agreements between Portland and Fire District 10, so they can't even litigate the issue. So, you know, what you have here is a circumstance where if we don't do some kind of a socialization of the debt, all of the parties, in fact, end up paying for first failure to disclose and then failure to bill on PERS part. So we were looking at something that we could call logical, although it may not be fair. But there is a mechanism that you can identify that we use to approach these things. The essential difference here is we can do nothing and allow this circumstances, these set of circumstances, to play out, probably to the detriment of all the districts. We can do this, which is a suggestion that we have from the working group, which is represented by Mr. Boyko's memos. And that at least socializes some of the debt and lifts the burden and apportions the burden in a way that we think is, if not fair, at least logical. Or we can look at some other allocation, which would be, in my opinion, relatively arbitrary. So those are the three choices.
All right. Ms. Roberts.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. I'd like to comment on a couple of the aspects.
Just do me a favor, though, and identify yourself. And
Leslie Roberts, I'm attorney for Fire District 10. I appreciate the seriousness and the hard work that's gone into the product. As Ms. Fori mentioned, all of us participated in an early work session, and it appears that this later work has come out of the activity of the working session only with the PERS representatives, and so it comes, there hasn't been any opportunity for the people who are expected to pay the bill or the entities from which the bill is coming to comment on these processes and the numbers. The number that comes out to $400,000 to Fire District 10 would make Fire District 10 insolvent. Insolvency has a couple of meanings. One is inability to pay debts when they come due, and the other is the excess of liabilities over assets. I think Fire District 10 would be in a position wherein, by either definition, it would be there. The Fire District 10 has a budget which it pays to Gresham to provide housing.
That's a little confusing because I was looking at Mr. Volko's memorandum. Well, to Mr. Volko.
This is the one that the senator was telling us that he was looking at.
Okay, which would have Fire District allocated $2,600,000, which would simply more thoroughly expunge the district as an operating entity. It has a constitutional limitation on what it can raise from that tax group or that taxing tax base of $1 million a year, and it has outflows of $1,000,004. There's
hang on. Did you have
the numbers?
Okay, hang on, Ms. Roberts.
I was just wanting to point out that the dollar amounts owed would be amortized over a 20-year period, and there would be no cash emolument required immediately. It would be a rate increase, and the rate increase is on the order of 1.34, I think, written on so a relatively small percentage of increase on the actuarial rate. So we were looking for a mechanism that would not bankrupt FD10. And the way to do that was embed the cost that was allocated to FD10 within their rate structure.
Since the district is now trying to find a way to survive after the next 2 years, perhaps by merging. This would
be an obligation that any merging entity would have to consider, and I frankly think it's unlikely that knowing how long we have been trying to work out a merger and how unattractive we are as a package, I think this probably means that there won't be any merger in our future and the district will go out of business. The tax rate is fully assessed. The tax rate can't go up. And if it doesn't equal expenses of providing fire service now, and our reserves from which we've been eating will be gone after next year, that's the critical moment. I'm not clear, Senator Ferrioli, that would increase the rate. We have only an employee who works about 20 hours a month. So we're not paying any significant amount to first on that employee rate, and we can't increase our tax rate because we're at the constitutional maximum. So I'm not too... I just don't understand what rate increase would be able to amortize this $2 million debt. I don't see where it comes from.
Mr. Chairman, that was also identified by the committee. In one sense, we worked this out. The $2,871,000 divided by 20 years over the roughly 2,000 properties that are covered by the district. It worked out to be about $72 per house per year. The problem is that, which is further exacerbating this issue, is that there's no capacity left to lever in the district. And that it's assumed that if the fire district 10 over the next 24 months cannot remain solvent, that those that territory and that tax base would be assumed by another district, or maybe a combination of districts. And we were under the impression that there was an attempt to try and find other districts that would negotiate or could be imposed upon in some way to merge to try to cover that. And Mr. Chairman, that is the last and probably one of the more nettlesome issues here. It is a determination, perhaps, for the committee about how much we would socialize, perhaps a larger percentage, based on their lack of capacity. So if we were, in fact, going to look at the socialization of about $34 million of this, perhaps the right approach in order to lift the burden from the folks that actually can, those 2,000 households, would be to simply socialize a slightly larger amount.
I'd like to also mention something about those figures. They're quoted as having come from a letter from me to Dale Orr in 1998. I saw this when I got here, so I didn't have a chance to check on what that letter was about and what it said, but I think I know where they came from. And if I'm correct, they were derived much earlier, sometime in the 80s, when the various municipalities were discussing the division of the assets in District 10, District 10 expired. And you must understand, then, that those figures were computed on a very horseback way based on percentage that any particular annexation bore to the whole at the time of the annexations. Some of the annexations going back to 1984, I think, is when they started. By the time the tide of annexation finished, the only thing left in District 10 was outside the urban growth boundary, rural land. The property that had been annexed was inside the urban growth boundary in one municipality or another. Since that time, in the 20 years from the first annexations, the rate of growth and taxable value of properties inside and outside the urban growth boundaries has not been even. Therefore, even if this number is accurate or was accurate at one time, you must recall it does not represent the current distribution of taxable value or the taxable value that will be there over the period of time that the working group is envisioning the debt being paid off. Consequently, it undoubtedly overstates the ability as a percentage of the property within District 10 to pay additional debt load. It's just not the same. The current value increase in a strawberry field in District 10, Holmes Field, not growing on strawberries, is not the same as the current value of property deep within the city of Portland that's annexed 20 years ago. But the really pressing thing on my mind is not the percentage, but how is the district going to provide fire safety and emergency life response for 2,000 families?
Mr. Chairman, let me concede the first point. I think the working group and anybody that looked at these numbers recognizes the capacity problem Fire District 10 has, just in staying solid. And further, the committee did, at least not within the working group, but in conversations between Senator Walker and I, we talked about one rather draconian possibility, and that was simply allocating Fire District 10 among the other districts and dissolving Fire District 10 by statute. That was not a recommendation that the committee necessarily, or at least the Senator Walker and I, were necessarily willing to bring to the table. But it just goes to illustrate, Mr. Chairman, that when these districts get in trouble, the difficulty is the services, if they're essential services, need to go on. And there's no way to extinguish the liability, not through bankruptcy or any other process, because these are pension dollars owed to working people who either are currently retired or will in the future. So you can't get away from that liability. And therefore, the conclusion of the working group was that they were, in fact, hers is, in fact, a pool to earn dollars and to provide a service. And if members of the pool become insolvent, then that is, in fact, the purpose of having a contingency liability fund. And I think we are at that threshold with Fire District 10.
All right. City of Gresham.
Thank you, Chair, Minutes, Senators. My name is Terry McCall, Finance Director for City of Gresham. I feel like maybe we should be grateful for having the shotgun not pointed at our head instead of having an ice pick to suffer instead. We strongly oppose any assignment of liability. I believe the other cities would agree, but they're not here to acknowledge that. We certainly do not acknowledge any liability. We employed no one ever from Fire District 10 after the merger or at any other time. We maintain that we never owed a dime, and nothing has changed that would alter that view. Now, I opened my email last night at 10 till 5 and hot-footed it down to the city manager to tell him I had to come to this meeting. And his reaction was that we're just convinced that this is indefensible, that any assignment of liability is indefensible, and that we'll have to look for any remedies we can to avoid that. I appreciate your efforts, the efforts of the committee, the one time, not two or more, that the working committee met in full, certainly has tried to find solutions to this, but we are still not satisfied that the solution has been reached. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, but is it logical?
if I want to put on my math, the math is logical. The underlying premise is illogical.
Mr. Chairman, I think, in fairness to the participants in the first work group where all the jurisdictions were involved, they may need some time to react to the committee. And I think we ought to let them go away and monitor this a little bit and come back with their recommendations of how this might be fair. If there is no equitable solution, we still have the problem before us of eliminating the possibility that this could reoccur. And so there are pieces of the statute that involve curves with the employer jurisdiction, so that it won't reoccur. That there would be, in any type of merger, there would be full disclosure and assessment and apportionment of actuarial liability. And then we still have the question about what, in fact, do we do with Fire District 10 and the liability that was unfunded that was created in those mergers. So, I mean, we still have the same choices. Do nothing, socialize some of it, and either look at or not look at some kind of an apportionment of liability. And if there's logical reasons or if there's arguments that can be made about why the apportionment that's proposed in the memorandum is unfair, we need to hear those.
All righty. Hence, we have the 813 amendment, which goes back to the earlier statements by the City of Portland that they paid the $40 million on behalf of Fire District 10. But it appears as though some of the members of this committee would rather defend Portland than find an equitable solution. So, given that fact, I don't know whether you think you can come up with a reasonable solution or not. I'm getting kind of tired.
Mr. Chairman, I've learned more about Fire District 10 and the impact of actuarial liabilities than I ever thought possible, and still I have no real good answer. I guess I would suggest that the work group convene one more time. And if we cannot come up with a recommendation that seems reasonable, that either this committee chooses a plan or we essentially just do the fixes that will prevent this from happening in the future.
Right. And, I mean, it appears to me that Fire District 10 is in a pickle notwithstanding. I mean, if you do this particular plan, you still have the potential of being insolvent. If you're stuck with the $74 million, you're insolvent.
Sure.
The effect of doing nothing is to take the $74 million and allocate it to the rest of the PERT employers by default.
Fire District 10, before this Fire District 10 had a problem and it was trying to convince other jurisdictions, mm-hmm. and particularly the idea of a regional fire service in East Multnomah County, that it was equitable to include us in a larger fold, although our tax base wouldn't equal out the cost of doing so, that we should nevertheless be subsidized, as rural areas are subsidized in larger organizations, like fire service, for the sake of having a complete regional fire service. If we come bearing a big liability, that becomes an even harder sell. So,
well, perhaps the other government entities, not Fire District 10, who don't have a whole harmless, can sue the City of Portland over the issue. Because we may not be able to get it legislatively repaired, but I think a judge who's got a brain in their head would probably find the same conclusion, that Portland paid $40 million on behalf of Fire District 10, period. Anyway.
It's been a common disaster, really, because no one did know for all these many years while the problem became beyond anybody's reach to encompass, so none of us can do this right now.
Senator Ringo.
I have two words, binding arbitration. Somebody needs to sort it out.
Yeah. Okay, so Senator Ted, do you think another little work group would help or not?
Mr. Chairman, I think what I'm really interested in is hearing the arguments from the different jurisdictions about what it is that they see as fair or unfair in the memorandums for Mr. Boyd. And at least that will help us inform the committee about, you know, what decision we might make.
All right. We need to get the League of Oregon Cities representative, wherever they are. Are they in the room? To get a hold of the cities of Wood Village, Fairview, and Troutdale and make sure that they have a heads up. And, you know, by God's grace, this session will end soon. So with that, I would expect that we're going to find a solution. It has to be fairly soon.
Yeah.
If not, then it looks to me like Fire District 10 is in the same boat that we were before. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm not accepting the argument from anyone that they don't owe anything. I mean, that's just not going to get us anywhere. That I think I've never owed anything. I'm not going to pay anything. And Fire District 10 owes something. Whether they believe that or not, I believe Fire District 10 owes something. It can be a small amount or a large amount, but I think everybody, if we're going to fix this problem, is going to have to share in this in some way.
Okay. Senator Stark, you have
Last tag, Mr. Chairman. I'm sensitive to some of the arguments that I've heard about from folks who feel that there is no liability, as Senator Walker indicated. But you have to look at the liability stays with the district. And as the district was assimilated by other districts, there had to be some sort of a connection between the taxing district and the liability. It wasn't necessarily the employees. But if you've got, if you've got a jurisdictional map and it changes, you apportion the liability over the jurisdictional map, but fractionally where those lines change, that's where the liability is. If there's a better way to do that, I need to hear that. Thank you.
All right. So when do you think you guys can be back? When do you all want to meet?
Yeah. And as soon as possible, Mr. Chairman. Let's give them some time to react to the memorandum.
All right. We'll do another 8 a.m. tomorrow morning meeting, 8:30. Let's make it 8:30 in the morning. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And that work session is closed. 2237 is not ready. 198. What time is floor session? 10? 10:45.
Mm-hmm.
We have caucuses at 10.
Mr. Chairman, nothing for this committee is going to be more complicated than this is today.
Yeah. All righty.
We had, Mr. Chair, we had other issues on 2278, other amendments that were on the
Okay, why don't we talk about that?
Yeah,
let's do that. Let's go back to the work session and talk about that. Council.
Real quickly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson of Oregon Law Commission has been here patiently waiting. There are two amendments before you on 2278 that I wanted to, other than the Fire District 10. As you may recall, 2278 is the Oregon Law Commission's public bodies bill, and what Wendy wanted was there's the B6 amendment that you should have. It's a very short amendment, just making it clear that the unit captions, which are these captions in bold throughout the bulk of the bill, are provided for convenience and do not become part of the statutory law of the state or express any legislative intent. That is from the group that worked on the bill itself. The other amendment that you have, Michael Mortar is from DCBS, and this there is the B12, which is, as I understand it, some language that was in another bill that then popped out of that bill by mistake. Is that, another way to rephrase, I should say, is this is some technical language DCBS wanted to get into the bill that would deal with some of the internal issues they have, for example, with how to deal with consumer complaints, if the definitions of different insurance lines. I spoke with Michael Mortar. He's happy to explain these amendments. I also checked with Holly Robinson, who drafted the amendments, and I would describe them as internal technical housekeeping.
All right.
For DCBS.
Mr. Mortar. Do you want to quote? Senator Walker.
Oh, okay. I haven't answered that question. I don't need to ask it. Thank you.
No. Yeah. Tell us. Just identify yourself for the record and tell us why we're doing this.
Thank you, Senator Menas, members of the committee. My name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Insurance Commissioner for the Department of Business and Consumer Services. I'm here today to ask you to support the B-12 amendments to HB 2278. These amendments mirror the changes that were in Senate Bill 252, which received bipartisan support in the Senate and in the House Business Committee. The B-12 amendments address several insurance issues, and these changes are proposed intended to clarify existing regulatory powers. Any substantive changes are not intended to be major, but are intended to help the insurance division to do its work better. The division staff has worked with the insurance companies, the insurance agent organizations, and other interested parties to develop this proposal. There are five pieces to this, and I've included a description of each of these in the written testimony. If you'd like me to go through all five of them, I will. The first one deals with the applicability of insurance holding company requirements to healthcare service contractors. The second one deals with the designation of the insurance commissioner title. The third one deals with recording of complaints. The fourth one has to do with the timeline for review of acquisitions and mergers. And the last one has to do with exempt insurers.
Okay.
I have a question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we could probably make this pretty clear to the committee, and it might help. Senate Bill 252, as indicated in the written testimony, came out of the Senate and went to the House Business Committee, and then it had a relating clause that was used for a minority report. And so the bill sat in the business committee, and I think it got referred to the rules committee, and it's still sitting because of the relating clause is so broad. So that's why we're here, to put this into this bill. Nobody can tamper with it here, and they are changes that were necessary to the insurance division and got a full vetting in both those committees. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct, Senator. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, got caught up in politics. Mandy Nass. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Great. Any other questions, committee members? We're in work session. Do we want to adopt this amendment? Senator Burdick?
I'd just like to be reassured, because I've just been learning more about House rules and things that if there's a question on the relating clause, it could potentially hold up the whole bill. I'm just wondering if we have assurance that this fits well within the relating clause. I've got no particular problem with the amendment.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate
Chairman, we have checked with the with Holly Robinson and all of her group, and they've assured us that this appears to fit well with the public entities relating clause on this particular bill.
And I haven't received any communication indicating that it does not, nor might they send you a little letter. Okay.
Chairman, I'm reassured
to
have that on record. Would you like a motion?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes, please. Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would move the B-12 amendments to House Bill 2278.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the C-12 amendments to House Bill 2278.
Is it
B-12? B-12?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, B-12. Discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Would you also like an amendment on the B-6 amendment?
I think so.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ringo.
I just missed the explanation of the B-6. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, B-6, the original bill, 2278, is quite, it's 160 sections, and each section has a unit caption, or each unit, each area. And the B-6s make it clear that these unit captions throughout the bill are for the convenience of the reader and do not become part of the statutory law.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the B-6 amendments to House Bill 2278.
Right, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the B-6 amendments to House Bill 2278. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered, and I think we'll close the time of the work session on that at this time and wait until tomorrow to see what the solution of Fire District 10. With that, we're going to be in a brief recess. At the request of the Vice Chair.
Okay.
All right, recess. Okay, Walker, you have an amendment to this. We heard the bill before, and it was much broader. What did you tell us about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 5 amendments are the most recent amendments, and they got and stuffed the bill because we did take the other provisions of the bill and move them into something else. I can't recall which, but that bill has been preserved in another bill. This is the issue about the Social Security numbers that I have incredible heartburn about, and the Dash 5 amendment just simply limit it to the university system and the community colleges, with the understanding that we will discuss the broader issue about businesses and insurance companies and all of those people who continue to use Social Security numbers, that we will discuss that in the interim judiciary committee where we can have more time to deal with the issue. I just felt like we ran out of time. I ran out of steam personally to deal with it, and I think this gets me at least part of what I had a concern about and students had a concern about. I had received email from students about the very same thing.
All right.
And I would like to let you know that I got a call from Lisa Zavala last night after I met with her yesterday afternoon, and the university system is neutral on the bill, which means they're not going to oppose it, in my language anyway.
All right.
And I've not heard from the community colleges.
Do you want to make the motion to adopt the A5?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've moved the A5 amendments to House Bill 2658.
Senator Walker moves the A5 amendment to House Bill 2658. Discussion. Is there anybody out there that wants to chat about this A5 amendment? Any objections to the A5 amendment? If not,
and Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2658 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves 2658, House Bill 2658. I'm having a hard time talking. As amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Walker, assume you want to carry that bill.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Work session, House Bill 3544. We have a series of amendments. Council, when you're ready.
Okay.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3544 is a bill we talked about a few weeks ago, and I want to go through the amendments that you have before you. Daryl Fuller is here. Mr. Fuller spoke, I think, last time we talked about the A2 amendment, which deals with wages, making it clear that delivery can be by other than mail. And I believe, Mr. Fuller, this is for someone else, correct? For the farm workers. I don't know if there's a representative here. Mr. Fuller said he could speak to the amendments if you wish.
I think they previously testified.
I think so. The A3 is Mr. Fuller's. This is, as my recollection is, dealing with the area of sales and making it clear that the protections on employee relations deal with not only salespersons but any employees. He spoke to these, I think, earlier and can refresh your memory on those if you wish.
Right, and Foley, you're here, right? Okay. All right, you guys are fine with that amendment, correct? Okay. So A2, A3, A6.
A6, we got the A9, Boley,
okay.
Which you should have before you. This is the one that I had Mr. McKean from LC speak to. This dealt with the issue that he found with Boley's rules. You might recall that he wrote an opinion. He believed that Boley's rules were outside of the statute. This language clarifies the problem that they had where you have the simultaneous terminations where there is the issues surrounding that unfair labor practices. This, as he testified last time, deals with that and clarifies the language and makes the statute broad enough to deal with Boley's rules. Then Mr. Perry's here on A6.
And I think if the committee may recall the discussion we had on the previous amendment trying to fix the rule.
Yeah.
This one attempts to deal with the simultaneous discharge of employees. I think the testimony we had was that the intent was to try to deal with a particular employer that discharges an entire work crew within a day, as opposed to larger employers that maybe have multiple locations and they may have multiple terminations, but they're not necessarily connected to each other in terms of why the persons were fired. So this attempts to deal with that.
Which one are you referring to?
The A9.
And if you'd like, I mean, let me make sure I could review Mr. McKean's memo if we need to refresh all our memory on that.
There was an issue about willfulness that was brought up at the last hearing.
That's correct. There was an issue. What happened was there was an issue with the statute's description of willfulness, and as I recall from Mr. McKean's take, what they did is they replaced that with this situation where it would be clear if an employee has terminated one or more other employers at the same time, on the same date the employee's employment ceased. This was the issue of, let me make sure I've got it. We can see if he is. I'd be happy to see
him. It seems to be like a who's on first discussion.
I think I can help.
You want to come up and try to help us?
Please, save me.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. There were two issues.
Your name is, again, I'm sorry.
Pardon?
Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Mr. McKean had identified two problems with the Bureau's rule. One involved the use of the word willfully violated. He determined that in order for the penalty provisions to apply, we would have to be able to demonstrate that the employer knew that the employer was in violation of the law as opposed to just violating the law. And so we've deleted the word willfully the second time in the amendment so that the employer, in order to violate the law, doesn't have to necessarily willfully violate the law in order to enjoy the advantage that the penalty discount provides. The second issue was with regard to multiple terminations, and Mr. McKean found that the rule that the Bureau drafted after last session exceeded the statutory authority by indicating that on occasions where an employer terminated multiple employees on the same day, that the provisions of House Bill 2867 would not apply. After the session, Representative Jackie Winters, who was the representative that introduced the legislation last session, made it clear to us, as did the governor before he signed the bill, that they did not want the discounted penalty to apply in the case of multiple terminations. We tried to address that in the rule, and Mr. McKean found that that exceeded the intent of the laws that was passed last session.
All right. Okie dokie. Anybody else want to testify on the A9 amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just an observation.
Yes.
Have you ever had a bank card that you run against the maximum and then the bank calls you up and raises the maximum? I mean, yeah, that's just wrong, right? I've been here four sessions now. Every time we run into an agency that clearly exceeded its authority, instead of going back and making them undo all the stuff they did they didn't have the authority to do, but we do. We legitimize it by giving them the authority to do it. I just think, you know, that's wrong. But that's just my perspective on
teaching.
I had a conversation with Mr. Fuller and Mr. Perry during the break about, I guess, my take on how this bill is now looking. I'm looking at the 9 and growth, the hand of growth. I think this bill is incomprehensible. I don't think anybody can read this and understand what it says. And I guess I'd like to just, if you look at subsection 2, that has about three negatives in it and refers you to subsections 3, 2, 5. Okay? Well, 3 is okay, but go to subsection 4. It refers you to subsections 5, 1, and 2. And then you go to subsection 5, and it refers you back to sections 2 and 4. And somewhere out there, there's going to be somebody who graduated from law school about a year ago who's going to sit down and read this thing and is never going to understand it.
Well, assumedly, all the people in the legislative council graduated from law school, too.
Well, I'm not going to vote for this thing because I don't think anybody can understand what it says. And I know that they're going to come and give testimony, and I don't disagree. Frankly, I don't think I disagree with what they're trying to do. But I think legislative council needs to write laws that are readable. And now this is not readable.
Just a
comment. I would love for legislative council to sit down and write in plain English what they're really trying to do in the statute, and then we could enact that.
Senator, I don't disagree with you. Oftentimes you do get these statutes. I think we dealt with one earlier. It was in juvenile law that was almost incomprehensible.
This is
went back and rewrote it and actually restructured it. I think it's much better.
I mean, Mr. Chair, I think if you ask them to come back by 8:30 tomorrow with something that is understandable, they can do it.
All right. Legislative Council hearing it?
Probably.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go through the rest of the amendments quickly that we intend to adopt.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the other one that you had before you is Mr. Perry's A6 amendment, and he spoke to this, and he's here, on the garnishment issue with processing fees for child support.
All right. He spoke earlier, and I think this thing broke down because this bill, the previous bill, got tied up in another committee.
Everything but child support.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. Everything but child support.
Right.
Sorry.
The issue I have, Mr. Chairman, I know it's from the 25th of July. Mr. Perry did go through that issue, and Senator Ringo said, I'm okay with amendments, but before moving the bill, I want more information on why it stalled in the House.
On why what?
On why that bill stalled in the House.
I wanted the political spin,
Senate
right?
Bill 332.
Mr. Chairman,
the O'Reilly fact.
Senator Ringo has to wait for redirect before he can cross-examine.
So,
this is out of court.
Since Senator Ringo is venting this morning, I thought, I don't know, have you had an opportunity to...
Well, I remember after the committee that was explained. That was explained, and frankly, I don't remember what the explanation was.
I remember
there was the explanation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to vote for this bill in whatever form it appears.
Whatever it says.
Exactly. I'd like to get the committee to agree to adopt the A2, A3, A6, and A9, and then before we move the bill, we'll get it restructured.
Mr. Chairman,
What about the A8?
With the consent of the vice chair, that's not being moved.
I'm quite disappointed in that, Mr. Chairman.
He's from the breaks my heart.
It's a great disservice to women in the state of Oregon who like to breastfeed on the job. But I will acquiesce to the vice chair and the chair on that issue. And we'll be back in the session.
I knew you had a sweet streak in you somewhere. All right, Senator Ariola moves the A2, A3, A6, and A9 amendments to House Bill 3544. Further discussion? Any objection?
No,
I want to get it restructured. I think we'll have legislative council look at what we've adopted, try to restructure and reorder it.
I will go down to L2 right now and explain.
No, you have to go to revenue.
You have to go to revenue. And then you go.
Who passed the bill yesterday?
All right, with that, we're going to be adjourned until tomorrow morning.
Carol?